The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Krotowski. This week on the show...
The ecosystem doesn't need more entrepreneurs. The ecosystem needs more people who can execute and love doing that.
The Startup Institute is a finishing school for the digital economy of the U.S., training people from across skill sets to be the best startup employees in the world. And now they're bringing their schooling to Europe. We speak to co-founder Aaron O'Hearn about the startup scene's need for the right kind of worker. And I'll be joined by the tech team to look at some more of this week's news and views, including wearable technologies, the talk of the town in Las Vegas, Nevada at the Computer Electronics Show last week. But some of the wearable tech on display verged on creepy. We ask, should we be worried if people are spying on one another? Also this week, Google's made two big announcements that have got tech tongues a-wagging. First, they announced that anyone with a Google Plus account can be emailed by anyone, even if they don't know your address. What it means to the privacy advocates and how you can opt out coming up. Second, the company formerly known as a search engine has bought thermostat and fire alarm company Nest for $3.2 million in cash. What are they and we getting from this deal? All this plus more over the next 30 or so minutes with the Tech Weekly podcast from The Guardian. To look at the US's airborne Argos catalog, SkyMall, with a mix of both horror and delight. Delight because of the pages of bonkers things that never would have made it through Dragon's Den, and horror that some of these things had made it to market after all. One of the horrifying bonkers things was a device that you could slip into somebody's pocket or stick to the bottom of a car to track where she or he went. A spy device intended, by the subtext, to catch wayward spouses or kids doing things that they weren't supposed to do. Fast forward to this year's CES, and one of the biggest headline grabbers was a wearable device that lets parents keep an eye on their kids remotely. Has little Jimmy or Jane reached the school gates? Has she or he veered off the path? Now, I admit, I find this future of parenting as envisioned by tech companies a rather devastating indictment of the way in which we have devolved our social interactions to technology. But then again, I'm not a parent. Thankfully, there are two technologically literate parents with me in the studio today, Charles Arthur, The Guardian's technology editor, and Jemima Kish, The Guardian's head of technology. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hi.
We are also joined by two non-parents, Alex Hearn and Samuel Gibbs. First, Samuel, you were at CES in Las Vegas last week. Did you see this device when you were there?
I did indeed, the KMS wristband. Effectively, it is, as you say, it's a tracker for your kids. You stick it on them, you let them go out into the world, and once they've breached your geofenced island, you get an alert. Basically, it's carefree parenting almost.
Does that exist?
with a side order of faint anxiety.
Faint? Yeah. Sounds like stalking to me.
Well, I have to say, my saying is always, the price of toddlers is eternal vigilance, basically.
Sure.
So, yeah. I mean, they geared this thing up so you can go onto a website or an app and see where they are at any one point. But actually, what it's really designed for is that emergency contact. So it's what they quote as the world's smallest mobile phone. And it was quite a small, it's a watch-sized device. You wear on your wrist, it has one button, and that one button is effectively like a panic button. You hit that button and it calls five numbers in turn until it gets a human. And it's intelligent enough to know when it hasn't got a human, it's got an answer phone, it just switches to the next number down the list. Equally so, you can call it and automatically answers, so you don't have the problem of parents trying to call their kids on their phone and then being ignored. It automatically answers, so you can just scream at them down the phone and it blares out of their wrist.
I'm thinking of the owl in Harry Potter.
Yeah, definitely. it goes as far as having a 2D barcode on the top, which encodes their blood type, their allergies, and their emergency contact information if they get lost. Now, It goes one step further than just tracking. As I said before, it allows you to geofence. So say if they have a particular route to school, you can define that as a safe route. And then once they verge out of that, say, I don't know, they've seen a bird and have chased it across the park, and they're into dangerous territory here, it will immediately alert you. You can define that what form that alert comes. It'll phone you, it'll send you a message or anything like that. And then you can see where they are. Now, Chris Etchells, the co-founder, kind of developed this over the last 8 months, but it's been an idea in his mind's eye for the past 10 years. And it was born of his work with vulnerable adults, and he saw the immediate application for children. And he said that in their testing, the kids actually took to it very well. And what they saw it was a license to go outside, whereas the parents would be paranoid without it and wouldn't let them go out and play. With the thing on, they were actually able to go out into the park, and the parents were slightly more comfortable with it in the age of when kid snatchers are about and things like that.
Jemima, this is part of a kind of suite of parenting tools that that various technology companies are bringing out. And one that we covered on the site is Cisco's Future of Parenting. What is it? What is their envisaging, their imagining of how we will parent in the future, technologically enabled?
Well, basically what Cisco pitched is what happens when a marketer gets hold of a technology. To try and sort of loosely summarize the kind of thing that they... the image that they painted, the remote parent can follow where the child is as they're on the bus on their way home, as they sort of dip into the cookie jar at home, and they'll get an alert because the child is gluten intolerant and shouldn't be eating cookies. And then that data and the data on what he does decide to eat is then shared with his doctor and dentist as well as his mother. And then the network notes there is only 90 minutes of sunlight left and that Aiden has not completed his 120 minutes of daily exercise. It shuts down the television and gives the boys three exercise options, and they choose to shoot hoops in the yard. Aiden's mum can track his heart rate and blood pressure as he plays. I mean, just, yeah, sort of, where do you start? I mean, as ever, technology is as intelligent as the person who uses it and the sort of the application for that technology. And you should be playing with your child, or you should be with them.
Alex, what are your thoughts on this subject?
Well, in a way, there's a very real direct line between what Charles was describing and the sort of horror stories you hear at the other end of childhood of parents following 22-year-old graduates into the interview hall and, you know, just keeping an eye on them there as well. Oh, well, no, remember, darling, you haven't told them about the thesis you handed in. That's fantastic, and that's a really, really strong reason why Ernst & Young should hire you.
Are you speaking from personal experience?
Have you met my mum? Not quite, so I've made it through at least one interview unaccompanied.
Well, you weren't in the one where I interviewed you, so yeah. It's a good point, though, that if children can subvert the technology, then they will. So what it might trigger is actually a sort of playground trade in, oh, I know how to take it off, and then getting a friend to carry your tracker back to their house. I just thought of this, so therefore a child could, so that your mum thinks you're at your friend's house where you said you'd be, and actually you're off in the park smoking fags or whatever. I don't know. If it can be subverted, it will be the children that do it.
Has this kind of thing been done before, technologically speaking?
Yeah, I think at every CES I can remember there has been technology about tracking in one form or another. And there's another one on the market for about £200 at the moment called iCare, which looks like a sort of ugly, very early mobile phone that they wear around their neck.
Samuel, as somebody who saw this device in person and also who saw the presentation and kind of felt the temperature of this kind of child rearing, this parenting of the future, how far away do you think we are from this dystopic future?
Well, the device itself will be out sometime this year. They're just going through final prototyping, so, and it'll be on sale. It won't be particularly expensive. It'll be under £200. So for those that want it, almost immediately.
You can read more about this and all the tech from CES at theguardian.com/technology. And speaking of privacy, former search engine and now everything peddler, Google has angered privacy campaigners this week by integrating their Google Plus social networking service with their webmail service, Gmail. People who have a Google Plus account can be found and emailed directly through a web search by people they don't know. Jemima, what is this new feature?
Anyone on Google Plus can find you and then send you an email, and that will go into your regular Gmail inbox. So they don't have to see your email address. They don't have to know exactly what that is, but they can still send you an email. And, you know, for people like us that already get a huge volume of email, that is a big problem. And we're already seeing, as Google Plus is being integrated more heavily into Gmail, with chats being replaced with Hangouts, for example. I don't know if anyone else has experienced this, but I'm already getting sort of chat request spam from people who are finding me through Google Plus. So it's very annoying, and it's annoying a lot of people.
Now, you can't, Charles, get out of having a Google Plus account if you want to sign up for Gmail, is that right?
That's the case. Now, if you sign up for a Gmail account now, then you will have a Google Plus account as well. It'll be a sort of a, it'll be a shadow account until you populate it, but it's, you're very, very encouraged. You're pretty much dragged down a line to fill in all your Google Plus details, including your real name, date of birth, all those sorts of things. It's interesting. I was talking to someone the other day who bought a Nexus 7 tablet, and said that he spent about the first half an hour of using it trying to avoid giving Google any data at all, because he said it was pretty much, yeah, for many people they go, oh yeah, sure, it wants to know my name, yeah, that's nice. But he's a sort of suspicious type, and he just wasn't going to be doing any of it. And it took a long time to set the tablet up, apparently. So yes, with Google Plus, you do have to have an account. People who got Gmail some years ago may find they don't already have a Google Plus account set up, but Google will generally have been prodding you to set one up, and it's quite hard to avoid now.
It's interesting the context in which these services are developed, because there's very much the ethos of eat your own dog food, as we know, at Google. So all of the engineers who build these systems live and breathe Gmail and Google Plus all day. So they'll get their Nexus 7 out of the box, and it'll say, enter your Google account to set up. And for people who've bought the device because they thought it looked nice in the shop, and then not aware of this whole, the wider sort of culture of buying into the Google system, I don't think those people are forefront in the mind of the engineers that are building the systems.
Alex, apart from the increased deluge of email that Jemima mentioned, why is this a problem? Why is it, I mean, anybody can search for anybody's email address online if they know the right things to search for, can't they?
There are a lot of people who have a lot of reasons to want to keep an email address private. The obvious ones are, for instance, people who have had problems with stalkers in the past, people who have abusive former spouses. I think that the problem is one step back. It's not that Google Plus is linked in to Gmail. It's that Google creates Google Plus accounts when you don't want or need them. Realistically speaking, if you have a public account on a social network, it's normally a sign that you're okay with having a relatively public profile and being easy to contact. If you are someone who has had a problem with stalking, you, in all probability, have gone through Facebook privacy settings and locked it down. If you're on Twitter, you might have a private account, or you might not be on Twitter at all. The problem with Google is, by auto-generating Google Plus accounts for almost every Gmail user and for almost every YouTube user and for almost every user of almost every Google service, there are people who don't know that they have this public-facing profile who might get a nasty surprise.
Now, we've seen this kind of this attempt to integrate services with Google before. And in fact, Samuel, there have been some spectacular gaffes that have reversed Google's release of services, like, for example, Google Buzz. Will there be enough of a response by people to turn this feature off of Google Mail, Gmail, and Google Plus?
I think it'll be divided into two camps. It'll be those that know about it and attempt to turn it off, and that includes basically anybody who's interested in technology, and those that basically don't even know Google Plus exists. Those people are the ones that are unlikely to turn this off until something happens. And it's funny, my own experience is, when I saw it, was I immediately tried to turn it off. I was only on mobile and I only had a smartphone with me, and boy, could I not turn that off. I attempted to. I went through so many different loops, and I don't know why, but Google seemed to block me from turning it off.
Is that just on mobile?
It was just on mobile, because it would do a continual loop. The page that you had to get to turn it off, which is relatively straightforward in and of itself. You can just hit a button and apparently it works. And I say apparently because I haven't managed to get to do it yet. But it wouldn't show me a mobile version of that, or wouldn't show me the desktop version on mobile. So it just goes to show you the resistance of Google towards it. I mean, of course, it's their new business model, collecting data, more and more data, and interlinking it, as we've said before. So I think it's like I said, it's going to be divided into two camps. How many people are educated to this by their, say, their children or interested others? I don't know. I think it's probably going to be a default on.
You can find out how to opt out of this feature by going to theguardian.com/technology, and you can also read up on more of this story. Google's having fun this week. In addition to the privacy concerns about integrating Google Plus and Gmail, they've also announced that they want into our homes by acquiring the beautifully designed app-enabled thermostat sensor and smoke detector company Nest for $3.2 billion in cash. Charles, what's the story?
Well, Nest was set up by Tony Fadell, who left Apple in 2008. He set the company up in 2010. He was one of the early team who worked on developing the iPod, which, of course, is the device that basically turned around Apple's fortunes in 2001. And he worked on one of the versions of the iPhone, which was the unsuccessful version. The version you see today is the one that was developed by Scott Forstall. But Fadell, having left Apple, moved on to Nest and had the idea of really looking at the smart home. And rather than doing a stupid thing like an internet fridge, which is what you don't need, he worked on the elements of the home that you can automate, which you can connect to the internet, which are actually useful. So the thermostat, because you know you need to get your house to the right temperature, and the smoke alarm, because it's quite useful to know if your house is burning down, even if you're not in the house at the time. And so far, that's what he's done. And Google has now stepped in and made this $3.2 billion offer in cash. Google Ventures, which is a sort of venture capital arm of Google, was an early backer, and so it seems to me that to some extent what this does is shift some money out of Google, out of Google's bank account and into Google Ventures' bank account. But that's sort of by the by, you know, it now owns Nest.
I think when you have that much money, it's just sort of those technicalities are irrelevant, really, aren't they?
It's like moving money from one pocket to another.
Yeah. How much does Google have left to acquire and invest in various companies?
Well, it's quite interesting because Dave Lee at the BBC actually has just written a post about, you know, what is Google not doing? And he says it's becoming like the by and large company in Wall-E. You know, and it's what is it not into? It's got robots, it's got self-driving cars, you know, the list goes on. And at the same time, none of those is actually things where it makes money. You know, it still relies on search and adverts around search to make the vast majority of its money. Google Maps, that's something that they bought in. Android, this company bought in. You know, Nest now is a company that's bought in. Motorola, which is a company which loses money hand over fist, is something which you bought in. Blogger, yeah. Do we know? Well, Blogger actually is an advertising stand, so possibly it makes money out of Blogger in the sense that you know, it can serve adverts on it. But for many of the other things, you have to say that they're still in the, if not moonshots, they're sort of orbiting a bit.
It seems to me the acquisitions are always funding towards kind of like machine learning. I mean, all these things all have some sort of AI or intelligence or connected data sensor systems integrated into them. And Google is, at its heart, kind of algorithmically based, and machine learning is its prime directive.
That's very true, actually. I mean, Benedict Evans said on Twitter that really you shouldn't think of Google as a web search company. You should think of it much more as a machine learning company, because that's really what it is now. And Google now is possibly the first outgrowth of that. That's really visible. But yeah, I mean, Nest is about finding out what you want to do and trying to think of it before you want to do it.
Jemima, in the New York Times, Mr. Fadell said, I guess it was last November, that Nest was a communications algorithm sensor, sensors and user experience running over a network to the cloud company. It wasn't actually just about making thermostats and making fire detectors, smoke alarms. So we've also heard a little bit about the people who are involved in Nest, some of whom were actually at Google before. So, I mean, surely this explains why Google's interested in acquiring such a company. They're not necessarily interested in you know, reducing CO2 levels.
I think you have to ask yourself if there's any way Google would have been interested in this company had Tony Fadell not been part of it. Don't underestimate that Tony Fadell and Johnny Ive, who is extremely powerful at Apple now, had an ongoing feud for years. And he was one of just a few executives who left because of the superiority and power that Johnny Ive had in the company. So for Google to effectively get a piece of Apple to get the insights into that company, I think, is hugely significant. He's an extremely talented, very persuasive, very compelling and ambitious guy. And I think people have rightly expressed concern over Google's ambitions. If you're worried about the visibility that Google has over your life online, arguably Google is now going to have visibility over your physical life. And being at the centre of collecting data from all of those, whatever the caveats in Nest terms and conditions, you know, that is the objective.
What, with a thermostat and a smoke detector? Why not invest in an internet fridge?
That is just the beginning. That's just the beginning of smart home and smart metering, and we've hardly seen the start of it at all at the moment. And don't think that because Google has paid a sort of nose-bleedingly high amount of money for this company, that they have a very precise, accurate strategy for exactly where this company is going. They've got so much money, they can take a punt. I don't know, maybe it's a gamble, maybe it's just a very safe bet.
Samuel, how much does Google have left in their coffers? How much money are they sitting on at the minute? And, you know, has this eye bleeding, as Jemima called it, or nose bleeding, I can't remember which you used there, amount of money that they paid for this company making even an impact, a little furrow in their giant haystack of cash money?
The simple answer is oodles. Google basically prints money at the moment, so they can afford to buy pretty much whatever they want. In total, they have in and around the $57 billion mark of cash, cash equivalents and marketable securities. But to put it in perspective, in Q3 2013, so the last reported revenues, they racked up $14.89 billion in revenue, which was a 12% increase compared to the previous quarter. Now, that's only going to go up. The current standing is we're expecting that to be at least the same. When you're generating that much revenue on a business that thrives on producing advertising and basically selling a product that other than electrical overheads and company overheads doesn't have a physical value, then you're effectively printing money. And so Google can really afford to buy whoever they want at the moment.
Good. Maybe they'll start paying more British tax.
So, Alex, they've bought a thermostat and a fire alarm, a smoke alarm company, which obviously, you know, has implications for future in the home. They've also bought Boston Robotics, a company that makes animal-like drones and robot dogs. Where are they going? And does the combination of this and what else they're doing out there by acquiring various interesting companies, driverless cars, etc., does this concern you? I mean, why are you worried about them coming into your home?
It's easy to simplify Nest down to just making thermostats and smoke alarms, but just the minuscule additions to them that make them smart. In the thermostats case, for example, it adds in proximity sensors, so essentially it can tell when you're home. That alone is an enormously important data point. Telling when someone is at home or not tells you a huge amount about their life. It tells you their daily routine. It tells you when and whether they've gone on holiday. It tells you, if you analyze it correctly, how many people are in their home. Because it doesn't just tell you when someone is home, it tells you when they're in different rooms. I mean, you know, if you completely ignore Don't Be Evil, what Google has here with its last few acquisitions is the most amazing burglar company ever. They know when you're away and they have robots that can self-drive themselves to your car and take your stuff.
They know when you're away.
They actually do. Nest has been very careful to emphasize that their terms and conditions only allow them to use your data to improve Nest products and services. Obviously, terms and conditions can change. The definition of what Nest actually is when it's an acquired subsidiary of Google is in itself something for the lawyers to argue over.
It could be a Nest burgling machine, though.
Exactly. At some point, the way Google works, Google as a machine learning company, Google as the world's greatest hoover for data that has ever been seen, I find it incredibly unlikely that Nest's terms and conditions will not allow Google to use some of that information at some point. It's going to be sucked into the Google data vault. It's going to be used, from an optimistic point of view, to let your Google Now profile tell you ever better things about how to get home, where you are, where your family are, what you should buy this week, whether you should try new red pesto over old green pesto. The scariest side of it is that, you know, if you come home from holiday, you're probably a little more tired than you were when you left, actually. You're probably wanting some memories of where you are. You're going to get different adverts. You're going to get more targeted adverts based on someone who's just been to Mallorca. Google is an advertising company. Google uses data well. Google uses a lot of data, and Nest is just another source of it.
Can I just say, this is so not true. You know, my wife's experience just recently was, she was searching for a sofa. She wanted to buy us a new sofa. So she searched for a new sofa, bought a sofa. What happens? For the next few days, she is pursued by adverts about sofas. So everyone around the table is nodding.
Yeah. Now,
everyone has had this experience.
I already bought that coat. I don't need to see more adverts for it.
So the reality is that this whole thing of the adverts are really well... is absolute nonsense. It's just not true, and we all know it as the fact. And the thing of, you know, that the ads will be better tailored to you actually is not the case. It's the ads are more desperate. You know, that's really what happens. We're pursued more desperately by these companies, which say, there was once a time when you really wanted a sofa. Now come on.
On the other hand, maybe we should be pleased by the fact that clearly they're missing that key piece of purchasing data, so they don't have absolute oversight over us.
All they need to do is add a little camera to the smoke alarm or the thermostat that will be able to look in your house and see that you have the sofa, and then the circle is complete.
Had Amazon bought Nest, it would have been much more scary, and then they could have sent their drones to your house as well.
To pick things up in their orange boxes and take them away. Well, there's more on this story at theguardian.com/technology. Now, next up, we look at the arrival of a U.S. phenomenon in Europe. The Startup Institute began in Boston, then expanded to New York and Chicago. It's now crossing the Atlantic with new courses starting in London and Berlin. Alex Hearn has the story. Alex, a startup college, a college for kids who want to go into startups, shouldn't they be doing something else like, I don't know, learning business or learning English literature or broadening their horizons?
What the Startup Institute is aimed at is essentially job switchers, university graduates, people who want to work for a startup and not, importantly, found a startup. It's people who want to be employee 2 to about employee 200, want to work for a startup but don't really know how to get in and don't have the full suite of skills that you need to be useful. If you're the second or third person working for a company, it's not good enough to have a focused single core of skills. You need to be a jack of all trades, and that's not just you need to be able to code and design and do the accounts. It's also you need to be able to handle people, and you need to be able to negotiate and. So what they do, what their pitch is that in a tight 8-week course, they will turn you into the sort of person who can be an asset to a startup. Their pitch is aimed at the sort of people really who have been working in a multinational company, a cog in a machine, and don't feel very fulfilled with their job, don't feel that their work is going anywhere, don't actually really see the results of what they hand to their boss at the end of every day, and want to be part of making something. And I met up with Startup Institute's Aaron O'Hearn, the co-founder and chief executive, who told me more about their plans.
Yeah, so the Startup Institute is a career accelerator that focuses on giving people, right, the individual, the skills, mindset, and network to succeed in a career within a high-growth company. Now, at the same time, we're also a source of high-growth talent for growing companies.
How much does London need the Startup Institute?
A lot. I think it's better to sort of take the opinion of folks from London that we've spoken to before deciding to come here. You know, I think in general, the London ecosystem is incredibly active and bustling. And so one sort of component to building an incredibly strong ecosystem is talent, right? So London is starting to develop a really wonderful capital infrastructure. The early stage sort of economy is growing really rapidly. But there's one thing that will gate or sort of govern all of these companies and their ability to grow, which is great talent. So for us, you know, we really want to step in and really make the ecosystem stronger by providing an awesome, awesome pipeline of talent and helping people really find careers that they love.
What do you think will be different in the UK versus the US and in Berlin versus the US?
There's always this pressure on the individual to do what you know, sort of culture or society or their friends or family says is the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And then there's the sort of internal voice that people have, which is, hey, I don't know if this is the right thing. And I don't know that I'm totally happy about the thing that I am doing. And so, you know, in the U.S., we've been able to really tap that and say, hey, no, it is totally acceptable for you to take a step back, invest in yourself, and really find a career where you love what you're doing. I think that the one of our big challenges coming into the UK, as well as in Germany, will be, I think that cultural pressure to not challenge, you know, that inner voice and not challenge sort of the cultural norm will be really hard. People are probably going to be less willing to take a risk and invest in themselves than many of them are in the U.S. You know, I think from the company, so that's from the individual perspective, from the employer perspective, I think it's going to be phenomenal. I think that the ecosystems in both London and Berlin are starving for an amazing source of talent so that their companies can grow. I think the real challenge, you know, will be cultural and from the individual perspective.
So this is the next question. I mean, why is it important to train people in this way? Why does joining a startup have a specific set of skills and talents that you need to be trained for?
Okay, so for me, the ideal sort of person that works for a startup is somebody who is really three things, right? They're a continuous learner, so they're constantly learning new things. Whether it's applied to their job or a habit or a hobby or their personal life, they're constantly learning. And they're constantly absorbing new knowledge and understanding how to apply it. They're also a truth seeker, which for us, the way we talk about that is, hey, this is somebody who is always looking for what's right. They're always looking for a better way. They're always looking, you know, to understand something better so they could do it more efficiently, more enjoyably, so forth. And the third piece is that, you know, individuals who work for startups and have success there are generally very aware, right? They're socially aware, they're emotionally aware, and we generally bucket that into a category that we'd call emotional intelligence. And from a company perspective, these things are super, super critical because as an early stage startup, I don't have the ability to train people on these sort of, you know, three categories. I expect them to just understand how to deliver, understand how to be self-directed, and understand how they're perceived by their team and how to really work effectively within a small team. Now, the reality is most people are not these three things, but most successful companies absolutely, unequivocally have these characteristics on their early teams. And it's like, if you think about, hey, how do we make an ecosystem stronger? Well, you know, let's build better companies. How do we build better companies? Well, we build better people. It won't happen on its own. It really takes some facilitating and the catalyst to develop these skills and to develop this mindset. And, you know, our perspective is we're able to do that for an individual so that we can help build a better company and we can help build a better ecosystem.
So what's the relationship of your graduates to entrepreneurs? Are some of your graduates going to go off and found their own companies? Does entrepreneurship have its own specific set of skills which you can't approach, or is there some overlap?
Okay, so there's definitely an overlap, but our perspective is the ecosystem doesn't need more entrepreneurs. The ecosystem needs more people who can execute and love doing that. And, you know, inevitably some people, I mean, this has happened throughout almost all of our programs in the U.S. Some people will go on and found companies, but by and large, right, we want to focus on the employees that follow the founders. This is employee 2 to employee 200. I think everything that we're coaching people on, you know, in addition to sort of some of those hard skills, the mindset and that emotional intelligence piece is totally transferable to building a company, and we hope that they build companies later in life. We just want them to go work for companies where they can learn, you know, from doing before they actually get out there on the battlefield themselves.
What about specific, like very specific skills like coding or visual design? Are these things which you teach, which you expect your graduates to pick up themselves, or which are actually overstated in the importance of being a startup employee?
You know, our program delivers three things: skills, the cultural mindset, and a network. Mm-hmm. I think that people coming out of the program and our alumni would argue that the two most valuable pieces there are the mindset and the network, right? Hard skills can be learned anywhere. Okay. You can learn online. You can learn just by stumbling through things yourself. The stuff that you can't really learn on your own and is much more difficult to learn on the job is, hey, how do I learn things best? Hmm. How do I work with other people? How do I deliver feedback for somebody? How do I take feedback myself and process that, and what do I do with it? How do I collect data to make decisions, and how do I know what are the right decisions to make, or how am I comfortable making decisions when I don't know the correct answer? And so are the skills less valuable? I wouldn't say that they're less valuable, but I think that, you know, there are many, many ways to learn those skills in a silo, but learning skills like development or technical marketing or visual design in a silo by themselves without the context of here's how they work in the real world and here's how you put them to work in a company and here's how you use them to grow your own career, those are the things that are super, super valuable.
What about criticisms of startup culture? Things like long hours for no pay with most of the gains going to millionaire VCs. Is startup culture, are you setting up graduates for exploitation?
No, definitely not. I mean, we, you know, one of the things that we do in the program is give one-on-one mentorship and coaching every one of the students. And so, you know, I think the job that someone goes on to take after Startup Institute depends on where they are coming into it. So some people are going to try and join a super early stage company as employee number one with very little pay, where they say, you know what, I'm betting all of it on the equity that I'm going to earn in the business. Whereas others are saying, I'm transitioning careers, I have a family, or I'm recently married and have a mortgage or home. I'm looking for a job at a company that respects me, respects my contribution, respects my impact, and provides me an opportunity to grow professionally and personally. I think very little of that and very little of somebody's motivation has to do with the economic outcome. But if there are opportunities for them where they feel strongly there's economic upside, you know, we're going to do the best we can to be objective about, hey, this is what this scenario might look like for you, but understand the risk or understand how the financing the company has taken will impact your role or will impact, you know, your ability to earn or will impact the people that join the company next. I don't think we put much weight on the economic pressure within this sort of startup culture, but we do definitely consider it and we want people to understand what they're getting themselves into.
That's all the news we have for you this week. Thank you to our full house in-studio team, Jemima Kish, Charles Arthur, Alex Hearn, and Samuel Gibbs. Tech Weekly is produced by Jason Phipps. I'm Alex Kratosky. We are back next week. See you then.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.